Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. What if I told you that today, most of the states with the biggest boom in Latino populations are all based in the American South?
Well, the reality, we moved to the South, we felt that being in Florida would be close to the Dominican Republic and similar weather that we grew up.
Well, that's not exactly the full story.
And that's Latino USA producer Jeannie Montalvo. And the man that you heard before her is Jeannie's dad.
Hey, Maria.
So, Jeannie, we decided to do this episode on the American South in part because of the fact that that's where you grew up. Your parents are from the Dominican Republic. They left there, end up in Oregon to go study. And then they moved to Florida. But then they actually ended up where exactly?
Alabama, which is very much the South. So between Alabama and Georgia, my family's pretty much lived in the South for a little over 30 years. But I never took the time to think about why my parents chose to live there or anything like that. Probably because I was too busy trying to find my way out of the South.
Wait a second. You were growing up there. I mean, why did you want to get out of there?
It's a long story, but I never really felt like I fit in. I mean, there weren't too many people in the 80s and 90s that I could look up to as Latinos, aside from my parents. But let me get back to how we got to the South in the first place. So my parents were born, raised, and married in the Dominican Republic. Right after they were married, they got a scholarship. This was 1980 now. And they went to Oregon on a student visa to study English. They got accepted to the grad program at Oregon State, so my dad did a master's in civil engineering and my mom did a PhD in chemistry. But once they finished, they were faced with kind of the big decision, do we go back to the Dominican Republic or do we stay in the U.S.? So fortunately, they were able to stay. They got an H-1 visa, which is a specific kind of work visa, and they decided to move to Tampa, Florida. But when they got to Tampa, things weren't as easy as they hoped they would be. And despite those flashy degrees, they had a hard time finding work.
So I had to work. I work with a graduate school, a civil engineer. I work in a construction building and a school in Tampa for 3 months doing basic labor.
So my dad worked construction at the time, like many do, under the table. But by the end of 1986, he finally got an offer from an engineering company that was building a plant in South Alabama, and they were willing to sponsor his visa. So we packed up and moved there. And that is where our Deep South story begins. We moved to a small town in Alabama called Brewton. It had a population of about 5,000 people. It had no shopping mall, no movie theater, just a small community college where my mom could get a job teaching chemistry, and my dad was close enough to commute to the new job.
So you're growing up in southern Alabama in the 1980s, and you're Dominican. What was that like?
Well, in 1987, Maria, we were pretty much the only Latino family in town. After so many months of job hunting and my dad working in construction, my family was super thankful for the job and for being able to stay in the United States. But my parents still had concerns about what life would be like for them in the Deep South.
We didn't know what to expect. I mean, we are too Latino. You hear a lot about the South. And it was really a little shock.
Yeah, I mean, they were pleasantly surprised. People showed up on our doorstep waiting to help us unload the moving truck. I mean, they already knew who we were. They knew our backstory. People talk about Southern hospitality, but for my parents, the South really did give them a familiar feeling.
I grew up in Santo Domingo, and people joke a lot about us, the Latin, that everything's just mañana. The South, in a sense, is very similar. They don't have that rushing for things. It's a more slow pace in the life.
So even though we lived in this quiet little town, Maria, where people greeted everybody with cherry pies and stuff.
Wow, it sounds kind of like idyllic.
Yes, everybody needs a cherry pie in their life. Aside from that, anxiety still kind of lurked beneath the surface for my parents.
I don't know. Your dad had probably watched movies. He had a sense that maybe the South might not be welcoming.
Yeah, I mean, as the only Latinos, my parents were concerned about what kind of future this town could provide for my brother and I, and whether or not we'd fit in.
And I was always worried about that you guys in a small town in the South, and where there's a lot of, I guess, prejudice.
That feeling of worry and anxiety that Jeannie's father was experiencing, well, that's something that many people of color in the South can relate to. The South, of course, was home to slavery in the United States, and then Jim Crow. So it carries a long history of racist intimidation and violence towards Black Americans. But the South is also where we, as a nation, continue to reckon with that history, as we recently did in Charlottesville, and as we saw during the civil rights struggles of the 1960s, when African Americans and others took to the streets and demanded a more fair society. Today, a new group of Southerners is being singled out, and in some cases being driven out, and they're reckoning with the question of whether or not they belong. And those are Latinos, because over the last decade, two Southern states, Georgia and Alabama, have passed some of the strictest anti-immigration laws in the history of our country. But here's the thing. At the same time, the top five states with the largest Latino population boom in our entire country are all Southern states. In fact, number two is Alabama. As we witness this new, browner South emerging, how are Latinos navigating all of this? How are they becoming part of a fabric of a place that is often seen as just black and white? We decided we wanted to see it for ourselves. So buckle up and get ready, everyone, because for the next two episodes of our show, we're going to be taking you on an epic road trip to the heart of the South. We're going to start in Atlanta and drive over 1,000 miles, making pit stops and ending up in a small town in southern Alabama. In this first episode, we're going to focus on the question of how Latinos got to the South in the first place. And in episode two, we're going to look at how the new political climate is affecting real Southern Latinos. But first, let's get back to Jeannie and her family story.
All right, so back to my parents. My dad was always nervous to leave my mom and us kids alone at home. Partially because that's just how he is, but also because, like he mentioned earlier, he'd heard things about the South. Things about the South not being as welcoming towards different races, and, well, he was also very familiar with the South's history.
So I was always asking our neighbor, even the chief of police in town that used to live behind us, and I used to ask him, hey, I mean, I'm okay. He'd say, don't worry about it. You are fine. Your wife is a teacher at Junior College. You work for one of the best company around here. So you're fine. Don't worry about it.
So because my parents had respectable jobs in town, they were socially lumped together with the other well-to-do white residents. While we made great friends with them, and they really grew to care for our family, they also started to warn my parents.
They started telling us, don't drive through this area over here. Be careful what you say over there. And then I asked my students, I'm from Latin America, I'm supposed to be kind of like in the middle. And they said, no, we don't have middle. They only knew these two races, and it had to be one of the two.
And this happened over and over again. You were either black or you were white.
So one time I came back from a business trip, but I came with a very bad flu. So Socorro said, no, you need to go to the doctor.
Socorro, by the way, is my mom.
But the only doctor I had to go to is a small hospital. So when I go there, they give me the form to fill out. And I fill out everything. But in the any group that they ask, you only say you are white or black. So I didn't mark anything. So I gave the form to the nurse. And it surprised me. The nurse said, what color are you? I said, well, I'm not white. I'm not black either. So I'm just Latino. And they said, well, you need to mark one of those. So I say, lady, this is wrong. This phone is wrong. Mark whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. elementary school, my parents tried to shield my brother and I from a lot of the racial tensions or issues that they faced while we lived there. South Alabama was very divided at the time, and it still can be in many areas. And the way my parents tell it, this was their first taste of it.
That was my first kind of like exposure to a really a strong division.
My mom first noticed segregation at the Blueberry Festival. It's a huge festival that the town holds every year in the summer.
You ask, why are no African American in this festival? Oh, they know their place. I mean, this is a white festival, and it's put together by the white community, right? There were people who told us, I don't shake hands with these people.
This was the late 80s. Alabama had desegregated by law. No more Jim Crow, no more Wallace. The civil rights movement had passed. Yet here, my parents were being shown a different side from the people they knew. We got more and more settled in town, and my parents started opening their eyes to things that they never noticed before.
My cousin was a Green Beret, and, you know, he was deep in intelligence.
A Green Beret is the nickname for the United States Special Forces in the Army. So, alternative warfare, foreign internal defense, special recon, counterterrorism, you get the idea.
So he went to visit us one time, and when he came, the first thing he said to me, oh my goodness gracious.
Too many symbols.
Too many symbols. I'm never coming again. So I said, what do you mean? And he said, don't you see that everything is written by with case? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, the quick car wash is with case. Quick, to, and car. So everywhere you read in this town is case. That means that the KKK is very active.
Seeing these signs made that cousin worry about our family, especially since my dad traveled so much.
So one night, he called me and said, is Roberto home? And I said, no, he's on a trip. And he said, okay, I want you right now to get the kids in the car, get whatever soon you can get in the car and start driving. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I just heard on the radio band that there's a march and it's going by your house, a KKK. And I said, you cannot be serious. This is really a sweet town. These people really care for us. This is, and he said, no, you never know because, you know, sometimes they can love you. But you're by yourself. I cannot tell you how scary that was, but I had to do it. There was no choice.
So my mom grabbed my brother and I. In the middle of the night, she packed us into the back seat and hit the gas.
So what happened? Where did you guys go?
Well, we ended up in Florida.
So was this like a big deal for you? Do you remember kind of like the shock of having to leave because the KKK was coming?
Honestly, Maria, I was like 8 or 9 when that happened. I have very vague memories. I mean, I do remember packing up late one night when my dad was out of town and driving, but I found out most of these details of why we did the things we did as an adult.
So how long did you have to leave for?
It was only overnight, and my dad was probably freaking out and calling the house over and over again. I mean, he had no idea where we were.
For your mom and dad, I mean, this must have really colored how they felt about the fact that they were raising their family in Alabama now.
Yeah, exactly. For my mom, packing up her 2 young kids in the middle of the night was not the life she envisioned for herself, and it's definitely not the life she wanted for us. So after that, Bruton had lost some of its rosy tint, and she opened her eyes to what had been around her all along.
Those were the little things that started kind of saying, okay, at some point we have to go.
We lived in Bruton, Alabama for 5.5 years. And in that time, we can't say we physically saw any manifestations of these hate groups in town. Aside from the symbols and things being spelled with a K or the street signs that were graffitied with the words KKK on them, we never once saw someone in a cloaked hood. But my mother knew of students who attended supremacy meetings, and saying the marches didn't happen wouldn't entirely be accurate. Had we not driven out that night, who knows what we may have seen. Regardless,
it got to a point that we felt that our tenure in a small town was over.
So in 1992, my dad requested a transfer to Atlanta.
In my case also, Jeannie, you know that as a mother, you worry about the future of your children. It's getting kind of like 3 more years going to high school. How are people going to treat the first Latin girl? And I was also worried about you being discriminated, because if Roberto got that black and white situation at a hospital, then you didn't have a category. It was either black or white. So for me as a mother, it was a very big choice. I didn't know how to explain to you the difference.
I mean, I still got asked in elementary school if I was black or white.
So while my mom's concerns were valid, it didn't shield us from the realities of what the South was like. And that's the thing, as a kid, you don't really remember every detail, but certain things really do stick out. Like the time in Girl Scouts, I was paired with the only black girl in the troop to make pizza, and someone said, "Ooh, you have black hands on your pizza." Or the other question, was I black or white? I believe my exact answer to the girl that asked me was, "I'm tan." Because, I mean, in elementary school, what else do you know? So even though our time in this southern Alabama town drew to a close, my parents still have fond memories of their time there. So much so that we're still in touch with many of the people in town, like my old neighbor, Beverly Stark.
Hello, come in.
Hi.
Remember Look at you.
Beverly's small poodle followed us through her home, which was lined with knickknacks. We made our way to the great room and sat by her piano. It had a music book of Christmas carols propped up against it, even though we went there in June. Now that I'm older, I wanted to know what she thought of us back then. So I asked her if she remembered when we first moved in.
I did. Roberto borrowed our wheelbarrow. Do you remember that? And you kids were little.
What were your first impressions of them when you met them?
How educated they really were, and bilingual, which I was so jealous because I wanted to speak Spanish too. But plus, I liked your mom and daddy.
After we caught up with Beverly and took a look at my childhood home right next door, I wanted to literally drive down memory lane through Brewton to see if anything had changed since I moved away in 1992.
This is Brewton, Alabama. Oh my God, wait, that means that we passed my old house.
The town itself was still the same. Same streets, all five of them. But Latinos are still a very small population, though now it's up to 2%, according to the latest census data. But one thing was pretty different.
This grocery store wasn't here when you were here.
Absolutely not.
There was a Latino grocery store called El Rincón. We obviously popped in because my mind was blown, and we really wanted to check it out. We found out the store had been there for only about 2 years.
It's packed. For a small town, it's packed.
The grocery store wasn't the only thing that was massively different. As an elementary school kid who didn't have a category, we were also part of another minority group. While everyone else was going to Southern Baptist church services, we went to Catholic Mass. My brother was baptized there, and I did my first communion there. The only Latina to do first communion there that year. This year, they had 9 Latino children do their first communions. Not only that, but the church now holds a Spanish Mass or service once a month. While I still couldn't believe that there was now a Latino grocery store in town and a Spanish church service, I couldn't help but think, if we put our little family back in Brewton, what would it be like? Would I still get asked if I was black or white? Or is there at least a middle now? When we left Brewton for Atlanta in 1992, it was before all these changes. So we weren't really around to see all these Latinos that now hang out at the grocery stores and worship in Spanish. But even in Atlanta in the 90s, that big metropolitan city of the South that everyone knows, our family still was one of the very few groups of Latinos in town.
But
But despite still being one of the few Latinos in Atlanta, they were happy to have moved there when they did. And they also happened to have arrived during one of the most exciting times for Atlanta. It had just been chosen as the city to host the 1996 Centennial Olympic Games. And the city was about to change forever. But we'll come back to that.
Atlanta being chosen? That's huge.
Mr. and Mrs. Montalvo were so excited about the Olympics coming to their new home that they bought an Olympic brick, kind of how you can adopt a bench at the park. To raise money for the Olympics construction, people could pay $25 and get their names engraved on a brick in Centennial Olympic Park, the site of the games.
When we moved to Atlanta, we were really just at the beginning of our professional career. And we didn't have enough cash to be buying bricks.
Even though they were strapped for cash, buying a Centennial Olympic brick with Jeannie and her brother's names engraved was a top priority for the Montalvos.
But it was more like, I mean, a symbol from our family. And it's also like, hey, this is your city, your country. You're part of it.
I wonder if they've, like, relocated stuff.
So, of course, we had to go on a scavenger hunt for the Montalvo brick.
I'm so confused.
Did you ever see it?
Yeah, we saw it once, but, I mean, it says, your brick info.
As we scoured the path with hunched backs, squinting for a brick that bears my name, I realized that I'd never really put much thought into why my parents decided to get my brother and I a brick at Centennial Olympic Park. To me, my parents just wanted cute memorabilia. But now I realize it was kind of their way of staking a claim in American soil.
You got it!
Oh,
Winning!
My God! You're between Dr. and Mrs. Smith and Barbara and Bob. Then it's the Montalvos.
We're forever ingrained in Atlanta history.